Let's see. Trying to find the document here. When did you file?
Oh, gosh, I can't remember. I've written down the date. I mailed it okay. On the envelope.
What's your first name?
Robert.
All right, let me try to find it. We have
Reed, R-E-I-D.
Oh, R-E-I-D. Okay.
Your Honor, I have that as docket 2002.
Thank you, Mr. Northrup. Appreciate that. All right, docket 2002. All right. I have it in front of me. All right, Mr. Reed, what would you like to say?
Well, when I got this notice of what the fees are requested here, looking at it, you've got accountants for the Chapter 11 trustee, and I understand accounting. That can be very involved and time-consuming. And I don't know exactly what their hourly rates would be, but I'm assuming it would be like lawyers, billable hours and all that sort of thing. So I figure that's maybe perhaps somewhat justified, and then their expenses at over $27,000, that's probably believable as well. The part that I take objection with and would be with Mr. Calvert. And I understand all the things that he may have gone through trying to make this a functioning enterprise, but it had the stigma hanging over the Northwest Territorial Mint, and in that respect, I see it as trying to resurrect a dead horse. I thought that was going nowhere. But what I object to here in particular is that for 2 years' work, his personal fees listed on his paper as $906,310, and I do take exception at that. I don't see that operating a business of that nature should be that expensive when these people were put in these positions, both the accountants and Mr. Calvert, to try to get this going, this operation going, so they could recover funds or make the operation work and over time pay back the creditors that the former owner there had stolen from so many people, me included. Well, that didn't happen. So I think the fee here is somewhat exorbitant in light of the ultimate outcome.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Reed. Anything else?
No, that's about it.
All right. Thank you very much.
Nothing personal against Mr. Calvert.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Reed. Is there anyone else in the courtroom that's filed any objections that would like to be heard? All right. As I said, I received supplemental objections and supplemental exhibits, revised applications, and I've reviewed them all. I still have a lot of questions. Some of them do come from Ms. Pell and Mr. Pell, who have filed a declaration with some number of documents, which I have here in front of me. While it appears that the professionals don't take them seriously, I do. I have reviewed them, and I have a number of questions based upon those filings that she has made. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through my questions with all the professionals, and then if any of you would like to make any follow-up remarks, but today I'm not going to be entering any order. I'm going to be asking for more declarations because I want to give you a full and complete opportunity to respond to what I see as the issues in this case. And I know it's hard for you to respond to a 100-page response from Mr. Hansen or Ms. Pell. You don't know what's important to the court, so that's what I'm going to tell you today. And I'm going to give you one final chance to respond to those issues with as much time as you need to file supplemental declarations, but that's how we're going to proceed. So let me preface my remarks by reminding everybody that the burden is on the applicant to demonstrate that the time spent and the expenses incurred were both reasonable and necessary. And if a time entry is deficient or if an expense is not properly demonstrated to be reasonable and necessary, the court will not allow it. So with that in mind, I'd like to first start off with my questions regarding Mr. Calvert, both as trustee and his accounting company, Cascade Capital. The first issue I have is regarding the services under the category investigation FBI. As I've said before, responding to subpoenas are necessary, and that's part of what a trustee and trustee's professionals need to do. So I'm going to allow time and expenses related to responding to subpoenas. But I have a lot of time entries that show meetings, preparing for meetings, preparing memos, even delivering documents at an accountant's hourly rate under the topic of investigation for FBI. For example, on May 15, 2017, under investigation-FBI/US trustee, there's a description of Mr. Calvert's time as, quote, office call with FBI on our work and findings, close quote, for 3.5 hours. I also found time apparently related to this FBI investigation in other categories, or at least one other category. For example, under insolvency category, Mr. Calvert billed 4 hours to, quote, meeting with the FBI to review findings on insolvency, close quote, on April 26, 2017. I'm not going to ask you to revise your time descriptions. You're stuck with those. But you're going to need in a declaration, Mr. Calvert, to explain why time spent meeting with the FBI, calling with the FBI, preparing memos for the FBI, updating the FBI on your findings is responsive to subpoenas. All right? Do you understand that?
Yes.
All right. And also, I'd like to see those subpoenas. Any reason that those can't be filed with the court, Mr. Guerin?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. They were grand jury subpoenas. I'd have to look into it, but if they are producible, if there's no restriction, we will produce them.
If they are, I'd like to see them in camera.
Okay, Your Honor.
Okay. Let's see. Mr. Calvert, I asked you at the last hearing to identify all payments to Cascade Capital. And your response was only to list the payment that was pursuant to the Knutson order for about $110,000. I identified in prior hearings that there were a number of payments to Cascade Capital that were identified in the monthly operating reports. For example, on April 28, 2017, there's a payment of $12,821 to Cascade Capital, and the description was for trustee fees. That's what I want you to describe. Do you understand?
Yes, I thought we properly responded to that.
You did not come close. You didn't identify that one. Why didn't you identify include that one?
Yeah, I think I can explain, Your Honor. I think I'll have to go back and pull the declaration, but in Mr. Calvert's declaration, he described the reimbursements of his trustee expenses. And there's a note in that expenditure detail that says that these things were flowed through his business credit card at Cascade. So they're reflected in the monthly operating reports as being paid through Cascade, but they were his reimbursements, and those are reflected in the reimbursement schedule that we provided for the trustee's reimbursements,
okay.
$32,000.
That's in his declaration?
I believe so, Your Honor. I'll have to check, but I know the schedule is there, and I believe the footnote.
Let me give you an example of the problem with the monthly operating reports with that. I mean, let's take a step back. The monthly operating reports have these categories and questions like, were any payments made to professionals in the last month? Mr. Calvert routinely checked the box, no. When then there's a monthly operating report and a bank statement showing a payment to Cascade Capital. The answer should have been checked, yes. There's no gray area on that, despite what Mr. Calvert may think that there's some sort of gray area, like maybe I should have disclosed it. It's not a maybe. Should have been. And it doesn't matter whether it was paid through Cascade Capital or paid directly to him. You're supposed to call those out. So I'm going to ask Mr. Calvert, I'm going to require Mr. Calvert to do what he should have done. the original monthly operating reports is go through month by month, and I want a declaration from him saying, I've reviewed every monthly operating report, I've reviewed all the bank statements, and here is by date and by purpose every payment to me or to the Cascade Capital or to any employee of Cascade Capital. Okay. Furthermore, if the original payment was to pay a bill of Northwest Territorial Mint, such as the utility bill, well, that's a loan. And I've said this before. That's a short-term loan. If you pay a bill of the company and expect to be paid back, that's extending credit. So on that same list of payments, you also need to identify any loans that were made. Do you understand what I'm looking for, Mr. Calvert?
I understand, Your Honor, but I'm not in agreement with Your Honor.
Well, that's unfortunate for you, but you're going to do it because that's what the monthly the monthly operating reports say. You're supposed to identify loans. Are you disagreeing that that's a loan?
Your Honor, what transpired in this case?
Can I get a yes or no to my question? Not a soliloquy. Is that a loan or not? You're an accountant. Is that a loan?
Yes, that could be considered a loan.
Then you need to disclose it. I don't need to hear anything further.
But I'd like to make a comment, Your Honor.
I'm sorry?
I'd like to make a comment.
No, put it in your declaration, okay? We'll be here all morning if you make a bunch of comments on everything. That's a loan. You just acknowledged it. You're supposed to err on the side of caution. You've been a trustee in other cases in this jurisdiction and other places, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, you've done monthly operating reports, dozens, hundreds, maybe?
Probably thousands, Your Honor.
Probably thousands. So you're familiar with the form?
Yes, Your
Honor. And yet you check the box no when in that there's a bank statement showing a payment to Cascade Capital. So in your declaration, you're also going to need to explain why you checked the box no when payments were made to Cascade Capital or to yourself. So you need to put that in your declaration. And that's what I think you're about to describe. Just put it in your declaration under oath. Okay. Next thing you need to put in your declaration is why you reimbursed yourself in Cascade Capital without court permission as required by 11 U.S.C. Section 330A1. Again, as an experienced Chapter 11 trustee and professional, you know you can't reimburse yourself without a court order. So you'll need to explain why you did that. Next issue. In the connection with the employment of Cascade, you stated that you read Local Bankruptcy Rule 2016-1, and subsection D of that rule requires that the hours, fees, and expenses to be broken down by categories according to the nature of the task. Examples of categories are financing, cash collateral, objections to claims, disclosure statement, and plan. Now, Cascade's hours are assigned to categories, but the expenses are not. You've described expenses such as travel, software, supplies, pacer, close down supplies. What supplies did Cascade purchase and why should the estate pay for them? You need to assign expenses to the categories you use for hours. If you're unable to do that, you need to explain why you were not able to comply with the local rule. Next category. On the AP list, you have an amount owing to an entity called Atkins Intellectual Property incurred in November of 2017. And then again, according to another monthly operating report, you have on an AP list, Atkins Intellectual Property, a debt incurred in April 2018. Isn't Atkins Intellectual Property a law firm?
I do not know. I'll need to confirm, Your Honor.
Okay. You don't know if Atkins Intellectual Property is a law firm?
I do not know.
Who is it?
Don't know.
Why? Well, you listed it as someone that was owed money by the estate. Did you sit here today? You don't recall?
I do not recall.
Okay. So you swore to penalty of perjury that you identified all professionals that had been paid, and apparently that was Amicus Law Group, but didn't include this Atkins intellectual property. So you're going to need to state in a declaration that you have reviewed every monthly operating report and all bank statements to determine that no other lawyers, accountants, or other professionals have received any payment from the estate. And if any have been paid, you need to explain why. All right? Do you understand that?
Yes.
All right. In regards to my request that you explain why you did not pursue any avoidance actions, with regards to the preferences, you stated, quote, many of the other significant transfers during the preference period were walk-in, same-day purchases of precious metal. I guess I don't understand that. Was that the company paying these folks who came in with the precious metal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so like that $500,000 payment to that one individual, that's what that was?
I'd have to go back to that individual one, but yes, people came in with gold and silver, and it was bought on the spot.
And within 90 days, you say that one of those people was, and I gave you a list of particular transactions, one of them was $500,000. That's what that was?
I'll have to go back and confirm.
I mean, that's a big one, obviously. I mean, that's one you need to specifically explain why you're not pursuing it, because it doesn't look like it was a one-time payment to this individual, and it didn't look like it was a supplier in any way. So, but that's what that statement means, that the company purchased precious metals from individuals that came in. That's what that statement means?
That's what that statement means.
Okay.
Your Honor, I'd like to correct the record. I'm going to say no, there were not loans, not yes.
I'm sorry?
I want to correct the record on my comment that no, it was not a loan. So we'll discuss it in my affidavit, but
well,
I want to correct the record that I think I misanswered that question.
Okay, so when a professional pays the bill that doesn't come to it but comes to the company, okay, utility bill comes in to Northwest Territorial Mint. Northwest Territorial Mint didn't have the money to pay it, right?
No.
Is that correct?
No.
Oh, so why did Cascade Capital pay? Hold on, Mr. Calvert. I've got you on the record saying that's what happened. I've got you on the record saying they didn't have the money. Let me finish. I've got you on the record. I mean, I do my homework before I come here, as you probably have figured out. You're on the record saying you had to keep the lights on. So Cascade paid the bills. And then Cascade paid the bills expecting to be repaid, correct?
I'm going to have to go back and confirm. But in a number of those situations, what it was is there was the inability to pay with a check to get it down there quick enough. The money was in the account, but I had to use a credit card to pay it to keep it on, such that it was a simultaneous transaction that I was going to get a check from the company to reimburse me for paying it on the credit card to get it resolved. So was it a loan? I'm not sure that it was.
It was. It was because, Mr. Guerin, it was a loan, Mr. Guerin, because, you know, it was Addison. This is like a whole preference analysis. You paid it, and then you expected to be paid back.
I may have been paid before the credit card cleared.
Well, that's inappropriate, too.
Meaning before I paid my credit card.
It is a loan. No way around it. You pay the bill of somebody else with the expectation to be paid back. It's a loan. Doesn't matter if it's outstanding for a year or 10 seconds.
Your Honor, we are happy to provide the detail, and we will be responsive to all the questions the court asks. I would like the court to keep in mind that Mr. Calvert, all he was doing was trying to protect the best interest of the bankruptcy estate. There were urgent circumstances that caused him to expend a few thousand dollars, we're talking about here, in
right.
the context of a $30 million plus case. And I hope the court will keep that in mind, because the context of this, Your Honor, what I want to impress on the court today is Mr. Calvert has done his utmost best to perform under very difficult circumstances in this case. And these issues, we've acknowledged to you, these reporting issues, we can clean those up and we can correct them. But these should not dwarf the efforts that the trustee has put into this case, which have been enormous and a great personal sacrifice. And for him to be subjected to undue criticism over these issues, which I'm not discounting, and I think we will address them. We'll clean the reporting issues up. There was no intent to hide anything from the court.
I disagree. Let me just disagree with that, Mr. Guerin. Let me tell you why. There's a reason why you're supposed to disclose in big, bold letters when there have been loans to the court, or loans to the company. So the court and other parties can determine what the financial condition of this estate is. And that is perhaps the biggest problem I have with how this case has been handled, in that this case is administratively insolvent, despite the fact I had been told repeatedly that the estate was administratively solvent. There was never any distinction that the estate was administratively insolvent on a liquidation basis, which now appears to be your position. I'm going to come back to you because I have you on the record saying it was solvent even on a liquidation basis. But I'm going to come back to you on that one. Okay. So this all fits in with the biggest problem I have with how the trustee and you represented this case to me. And by hiding the ball of loans that the company wasn't liquid enough to pay its utility bill, if I had known that, I may have done something sooner. That's why it was hiding the ball. And that's why it's not just a little minor blip. Apparently now, this estate was going down fast right from the beginning. But that was never conveyed to me. Ever, 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 Mr. Guerin. And not telling me about loans that Cascade Capital was making continued the pattern of hiding the problems this estate was having. And so that you can try to respond to that now or further in your briefings, but that is the position that I find myself in. And this is what judges desperately try to avoid, is administrative insolvency. And I strongly disagree with your recent filings that you've paid administrative claims. The Hoffs, the former employees, Mr. Atala, all settled at deep discounts because there was not enough money to pay their claims. So you can't take credit that you paid their claims in full when you made them take a big discount. You didn't have the money to pay their claims in full. And that's in your own paperwork supporting your settlements.
The fact that the estate was administratively solvent at the time we settled on some of those administrative claims was a factor in our discussions, Your Honor. But all of those claims were disputed claims that were settled after great effort to work through the legal issues and the factual issues that surrounded those claims. And I do want to come back and I want to address your issues about, were we forthright in telling the court about the status of the case on an administrative insolvency basis? I think we could have been more direct, and we could have recognized the risks that were involved through the spring of 2017 in front of the court. I think we could have done a better job telling the court that there were significant risks that this thing could disappear, it could fall apart. But what I will tell you is through the spring of 2017, we all had a good faith belief, the committee, the trustee, and myself, that this case could be restructured and we would come forward, we had a going concern value, it would benefit the creditors. We would not have been putting that kind of effort into the case if we thought otherwise. And there was, I can tell you straightforwardly, Your Honor, there is no intent to try to deceive this court about any of these issues. I think the question about these loans, I think, as I've said before, I think they are small dollar numbers in the big comparison. The trustee was not trying to disguise those issues. They were reported. The numbers were reported in the monthly reports. They were not categorized properly. We've acknowledged that, and we can correct the record on those things. But what I'm telling you is we did not intentionally try to deceive the court about the status of the case, going back to we had a good faith belief that we could reorganize this company and we could bring a dividend to the creditors, and that's why we continue to exert the efforts that we did.
I believe all of that. I believe you believed you can turn things around, but sometimes the court has to be able to make the decision to override the trustee. And I have other creditors to think about. You all can decide to take a flyer if you want, but then there are other administrative creditors that came in, huge ones. Well, and let me finish here. When I asked you at the hearing on the Atala employment, I said, I'm sure you've read the transcript. I said, notwithstanding the fact that the committee was supporting it, I was still concerned. And I asked you point blank, is this a state administratively insolvent if you lose the Medallic litigation? Yes. I go, what if this is a complete liquidation? You said, I think so. And then at the last hearing on December 7, you stood up and said, we all knew from the beginning. I never was sure of what you knew, if it was just Mr. Calvert keeping it to himself. You knew that the estate was administratively insolvent, even on a liquidation basis. You didn't say that.
I understand that. I acknowledge that, Your Honor. And for that, you know, looking back in hindsight, I wish I would have told you, would have accentuated the risk or described the risks of what would have happened if things fell apart. But, you know, our belief at the time, we looked at the monthly operating reports at the time, just on an asset basis, we believe we had sufficient resources to pay the professional expenses and what had been accrued to that point. I appreciate that if we lost the Medallic piece and everything fell apart and we went back and we looked retrospectively what the effect of that would have been, yes, there would have been, right from the beginning, there wouldn't have been enough resources to satisfy the administrative claims of winding the company up. But at the time of the Atala hearing, we believed that we had a going concern company, that we still had an ability to sell on a going concern basis. And on that basis, the company was administratively solvent, and that's what I was conveying to the court.
Okay, but you can't get by the fact that I specifically asked on a liquidation basis.
And I hear that, Your Honor.
And it's not just that. Even after that, I went back and looked at the litigation adversary proceeding with Medallic, and you know that Mr. Hansen was, through his lawyers, were constantly saying the estate is administratively insolvent, and you would vehemently, you called it slanderous in a footnote. Let me just be clear. You gave me no hint that the estate was administratively insolvent on any basis. In fact, you affirmatively said that it was on a liquidation basis. So I've gone through, I can pull out about 10 examples of where you said the estate is administratively solvent. You vehemently opposed, rejected, argued against Mr. Hansen's statements. You said it to Mr. Northrup in emails. You were constantly saying the estate was administratively solvent. If you meant that it was administratively solvent only on a going concern basis, you never made that clear. Until the fee applications, which I required last October, when things looked really awful and now you're coming forth seeking millions of dollars in fees, now the news, in the view of the court, the new story is this case was a disaster when we took it over and we couldn't work a miracle. And I find those positions to be incongruous and, in fact, directly misleading when I asked the questions. You know it was important to me, and that's why I come back to this notion of not telling the court that there were loans, not telling the court that the company wasn't paying its debts. All that, if it was disclosed in the monthly operating report, could have said, what's going on here? And maybe the explanation was, well, it's just a timing issue. I don't know, but you don't give anybody a chance to ask the questions if you don't put it on the monthly operating report. So that's the problem I have. I'm going to just leave that for now. Could go on about that, but you can tell, I'm sure you can tell that the court is very upset with that, because that's the biggest problem now, is I've had administrative claims that are not being paid in full beyond just the professionals. And I have to look out for those creditors, notwithstanding that you all are willing to take a flyer. The landlord didn't sign up to take a flyer. The employees who had Warren Act claims didn't sign up to take a flyer. Mr. Atala didn't sign up to take a flyer.
Your Honor,
I'm glad you find that funny, Mr. Calvert. Nothing
Your Honor,
about
you
this
don't have
funny.
Half the information of what went on and some of that stuff, and I'd love to put it in my affidavit, and you will get it.
That's great. And I'm going to ask you about why you hired Mr. Atala, given your current criticism of him. You can put that in your declaration, too.
I'm glad to, Your Honor. Okay.
Well, Your Honor, for the record, each of those claims were disputed claims. The landlord was handsomely compensated in this case, handsomely compensated from our perspective. We had significant ongoing disputes with the Hoffs, and we settled with them on terms that were acceptable to them on an allowed claim and paid the Hoffs. It's the same with the Warnack claims, which we went to a mediation in order to resolve those issues. Those claims were paid in full. And as we sit here today...
The settled claims were paid in full. The allowed claims, based upon a settlement, was paid in full. But they were... They agreed to lesser amounts, true or false. They agreed to lesser amounts because you made it clear to them that there was not going to be sufficient money to pay their claims in full, in part.
They would have their own reasons for why they settled. I will tell you straightforwardly, one of the issues we discussed in those settlement negotiations was the solvency status of the administrative insolvency of the estate. Yes, it was a factor.
Yeah.
I'm sure it was a factor in their decisions. But sure. There were many other factors. And that's the nature of compromising disputed claims.
I understand, but you've admitted the estate was administratively insolvent.
Of course we have.
Okay, so there is no doubt that even if they had gone to the mat and had the claim allowed in full, they weren't going to get paid in full. There was no way they were ever going to get paid in full because you've acknowledged the estate was administratively insolvent. That's my point, is that you other people were harmed by the estate being administratively insolvent besides the professionals. That's my point. And the court has a duty. The judges don't like administratively insolvent cases. They hate it.
Neither do the professionals, Your Honor. Well, I can assure you that.
Right, I'm sure you do, but you guys decided you were going to take this case, and you could have bailed. You could have liquidated it. I mean, Mr. Calvert said in June of 2016, he thinks he could sell the business for $5 million. That was after he sold the Texas assets for $1 million. What were professional fees then?
I don't recall.
Not much. Seven. There would have been a return on secured creditors.
Oh, I don't think that's true. I think that I can't remember what the fees were. We do have to go back and look at the numbers, but I don't believe we could have.
You were 2 months into the case. The fees weren't $5 million, that's for sure. In other words, there were points in this case where if Mr. Calvert, which, again, there's evidence before me where he's telling folks the business is worth $5 to $7 million, the question is going to be asked, why didn't he sell it for $5, $7 million? And, I mean, and if you want to continue with the case to get more money, that's fine, and you want to risk it. But if you are now putting other folks at risk, I need to know that. And this comes back to, I was not told the truth about the financial condition of this estate. And if I had been, then maybe I would have shut this down and I wouldn't have allowed the Hoff's lease to be assumed and create $1 million admin claim exposure. That's the thing.
I want to finalize the thought, Your Honor, on the issue about administrative claims in the case. Those disputed claims in their allowed amounts have been paid in full with the exception of under $10,000 of administrative debt. That's the status of the case today. So in terms of have the other administrative creditors been paid, all of the secured claims have been paid and all but $9,300, I believe, is the number of the administrative debt other than the professionals has been paid in the case.
Well, again, to be clear, the estate was administratively insolvent. So when you say paid in full per the settlement, that's true. But they were never going to be paid in full even without a settlement. Right? There's no way to pay them in full. And again, it's at least in one of the pleadings in support of the settlement was the employees recognized that there was not enough money to pay them. So you said that was a factor in their settlement.
I agree it's a factor, okay. But Your Honor.
We're beating a dead horse here. The state was administratively insolvent, and the court wasn't given an opportunity to make a reasoned decision on motions before it. Let's continue on. This is in the Cascade Capital application. In the time entries, there are entries called, quote, proof of claim, close quote. No verb. Sometimes, as I said before, 9, 10, 14 hours. obviously block billing, which is generally not allowable, but you just need to provide an explanation of why it was necessary to review proofs of claim. So that needs to go in your declaration, Mr. Calvert.
Yes, well, Your Honor.
All right, thank you. With respect to Mr. Atala, you have recently alleged that he failed to perform under his contract. So in your declaration, please state specifically how he failed to perform, and also like for you to state your due diligence prior to entering into an agreement with him. If your due diligence was based on the recommendation of anyone, I want you to identify the person and how you know the person. Stating that the person is a business associate is not sufficient. You'll need to state the specific business relationship you have with the person or persons. Next item. According to the committee meeting minutes of February 28, 2017, you informed either the committee or Mr. Northrup that you sold some coins to dealers in the ordinary course of business, and you also sold some inventory in May 2016 based on your research of the value of the coins. Is that correct, if you recall?
I'll put whatever my knowledge is in the affidavit, Your Honor.
Bless you. All right, so I want to know, did you sell inventory, which would not be an ordinary course transaction, did you sell any of that in May of 2016? And if so, who did you sell it to? How much did you sell it for? Explain why you didn't obtain an order and why you didn't disclose it in the monthly operating report. Mr. Guerin, do you have anything to add on that? Or
well,
you look like you're about to say something.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think we'll go investigate and we'll provide you. I think there is an issue about what's ordinary course here, and I think that it might be helpful for us to provide some briefing on the ordinary course issues, to address those concerns with the court. Raised.
You're free to do more legal briefing, but I don't think it's necessary. Again, according to these minutes, you said you sold some coins in the ordinary course, and you also sold some inventory. So that, to me, says you're acknowledging that the sale of the inventory was not a part of the ordinary course sales of coins. But if you want to argue that it is, it doesn't matter. I want to know who you sold inventory to. And if your answer is we didn't disclose it and didn't obtain an order because we believed it was ordinary course, that's your answer. But I will determine whether or not that's an appropriate or legally sufficient answer. According to those same committee minutes, you informed either Mr. Northrup or the committee that some items, including a spectrometer, were sold without your knowledge in August of 2016. Is that true?
I'll put it in my affidavit, Your Honor.
Okay. You'll need to put whether or not that happened and how it happened, who was responsible for the sale, what happened to the person or persons who sold those items without authority. You'll need to identify to whom the items were sold. You'll need to explain why it was not disclosed in the monthly operating report, and I checked it wasn't. You also, according to those minute meetings, stated that you said the spectrometer could be recovered if someone could identify a buyer who would pay more. And if that's the case, please explain your declaration how that was possible. And if I didn't say, you need to identify who you sold it to, who it was sold to. Okay. Next item on the agenda. Apparently on April 17, 2017, you forwarded the agenda for a committee call regarding the Bressler settlement to Connie Hoff. Is that correct?
I will put it in my declaration, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, I got the email here. You forwarded it. You're going to have to explain why you did that, because we know you did. And the question also is, did you forward the attachments that are referenced in that email to her? Okay. So you put that in your declaration. I also like for you to attach your declaration all of your communications with the Hoffs, including all attachments from the beginning of the case to present. And that may be a lot, but I want to know, I mean, Part of Mr. Guerin's efforts in the spring of 2017 was to go after people who you believe were making improper disclosures. I know from the litigation over the lease with the Hoffs that Mr. Calvert disclosed a lot of stuff to Mr. and Ms. Hoff, Mr. and Mrs. Hoff. So I'm going to evaluate the intensity and frankly, the overzealousness in trying to pursue leaks of disclosure of confidential information if the trustee is disclosing the same information to other people. So I want to see all those communications with the Hoffs, including attachments. Next, in your declaration, I need to know what is there left to do in this case? And why haven't those actions been taken? And when will they happen? I don't know why this case, if there's, for example, a motion to approve an agreement with Mr. Wagner, which I guess he apparently has decided he's no longer interested in, but that's been ongoing for 6 months. You know, where are we? What are we going to do? I just need to know what's going to happen next. And finally, Mr. Calvert, I need copies of all your communications with Mr. Richard Bressler and or his counsel from March 1, 2017 to present. Again, including all attachments. Mr. Guerin, in your supplemental declaration, I want you to address your representations to the court in February 2017 when I asked you if the estate was administratively solvent on a liquidation basis, and you stated, I think so, and why you said that in light of your statements, recent statements, that everyone knew the estate was administratively insolvent from the beginning. So you need to put that in your declaration. Let me ask Mr. Northrup. Mr. Guerin has been saying that the committee knew that the estate was administratively insolvent. Is that the case?
The committee didn't know that the estate was insolvent, certainly not on a going concern sale basis. And up through even 2017, you know, there were offers to purchase the business for $10 million, which was far in excess of the administrative fees at the time. So no, that's not accurate.
Well, so did Mr. Calvert or Mr. Guerin present any information, communications, presentations saying the estate was administratively insolvent, even on a liquidation basis? Let me add to that. Prior to October 2017, when they filed the report saying the estate was administratively insolvent back to August. So at that point, the world has been told the estate was administratively insolvent in Mr. Calvert's opinion from the beginning of the case. But prior to that, had you received anything from Mr. Calvert's side saying the estate was administratively insolvent on either a going concern or a liquidation basis?
No, I don't believe so.
So when Mr. Guerin says everybody knew the estate was administratively insolvent, including the committee, you don't agree with that statement?
Well, I don't. I think there was always a hope extended that, again, worst case scenario, there was an offer that came in towards the end of 2017 for $10 million. The buyers were not substantial and flaked out and went away, but right, that offer did exist, and there were offers like that. I know, right, Mr. Calvert was still shopping the business all the way through the end of 2017.
Right. I guess some. I understand. I mean,
the
still,
answer is no.
That's what I'm trying to get at. The statement was the committee knew from the beginning the estate was administratively insolvent. And all I have is emails. I've got an email from Mr. Guerin to you on March 14, 2017, stating it's not true the estate is administratively insolvent. Isn't
correct,
that right?
Correct. Yes, okay, that's correct. So, and that was my belief.
Did Mr. Guerin or Mr. Calvert ever tell you that we believe the estate is administratively insolvent on any basis prior to October 2017?
Not to my knowledge. Okay.
Mr. Guerin, do you have any? You and Mr. Calvert need to put in your declarations any evidence, communications, presentations, documents, anything showing that you communicated your belief that the estate was administratively insolvent on a liquidation basis. Do you have anything?
You know, what I can recall is we talked a little bit about this, and I think what we have in Mr. Calvert's declaration presently is he made a presentation at the initial meeting of creditors, and he informed people there would be no return to unsecured creditors unless the business could be reorganized. And I am confident that we did discuss with the committee, and I think we keep dancing around this issue, Your Honor, and when we use the term the estate was administratively insolvent, the estate was not administratively insolvent, and we have said this, Mr. Calvert said this in his declaration, it was not administratively insolvent until the company failed and there was no opportunity to sell it on a going concern basis. But what we did talk about was that if this case melted down and we could not achieve a reorganization, we could not sustain the going concern value of the company, there would be no return to the unsecured creditors. And, you know, did we specifically talk about it in the committee meetings that it was administrative insolvent? I know that the committee knew that it was a disaster. And can I specifically recall here sitting today, did we give them something that we give them an analysis? I do recall Mr. Calvert reminded me that we did a liquidation analysis in connection with our draft of the plan in November of 2016. So I'll go back and look at that and see what the details of that were. But I believe there was information provided to the committee under which that they knew in a meltdown circumstance the case was a disaster, and whether we specifically talked about it would be administratively insolvent at that point, I don't recall as I sit here today.
Well, again, I go back to what you said on December 7th, which is everybody knew the estate was administratively insolvent, and your email to Mr. Northrup, again, all the communications to the court and apparently to the committee was this estate is not administratively insolvent. And we all know what that means. We're professionals. We know what that means. If you meant it as just on a going concern basis, you never made that distinction. But if you've got something that's going to support your statement on December 7 that the committee knew that the estate was administratively insolvent, I need you to provide that. Now, next thing for you, Mr. Guerin, also follows the issue with the expenses. And again, local bankruptcy rule required you to break down the expenses by categories according to the nature of the task. I've got many, many, many expenses under matter number 9999, copying, Westlaw, court reporter supplies, without them being tied to any particular category. I don't know if they're for Medallic litigation. I don't know if they're for Erdman litigation. I don't know if you can assign them at this point, but you can't get reimbursed for them unless you tell me what they're connected to. And that local rule says it pretty clearly.
We'll take a stab at it, Your Honor. Okay. I can tell you I've been filing fee applications in this jurisdiction for more than 25 years, yeah. And we've done it the same way, and it's never come up before. So I'm happy to do that. I'll go back, and I will seek to allocate those categories.
Sure, but you probably haven't done a fee app every 2.5 years when it's $3 million. That's the problem. If you do it every 120 days, it's a little bit more manageable. That's and you guys have decided to, you know, for whatever reasons, didn't want to apply for fees every 120 days, and here we are. So unfortunately, that decision on your part to not follow the rule's pretty clear. You didn't follow it, and because we're now at a stage where this is the first likely or maybe the final, I don't know, but there's not much left, but you have 3.5 years worth, I'm sorry, 2.5 years worth of expenses that are, you know, tons of Westlaw, tons of photocopying. I don't know what's for. So you need to comply with the local rule. And I think that's the difference with those your other fee applications in other cases where you don't have that big amount to have to peel through. Let me now turn to some other communications. And let me just preface this by saying, I am deeply troubled by your efforts to interrogate and get documents from the committee members. And I'm not happy that Mr. Northrup let that happen. It's at best inappropriate for the other lawyer to be investigating another lawyer's clients for alleged breach of an agreement. But I'm more troubled by some things that were said in emails. So let me turn to those. In an email of May 10, 2017 to the Pels, you, Mr. Guerin, asserted that neither you nor the trustee had received any disclosure of communications that they may have had with Ross Hansen. Didn't Mr. Northrup send you documents that showed the Pels communications?
I think he had, Your Honor, I think the thrust of the communication I was having with the Pels at that point was I reached out to them and sought to do what I did with all of the other committee members, which was to get a clearing statement from them, from each of them. And all of the other committee members gave me such a statement, gave me a declaration that said they had not had communications with Mr. Ross Hansen. And that's what we were trying to do. So I think the issue about the confidential disclosure aspect of this, I think you need to broaden what was the trustee really doing in this investigation.
Right.
We'd had conversations with the committee from the very outset of the case in which we told the committee it's important that we keep all of our communications confidential with respect to Mr. Ross Hansen. He is the, he's already said that he's the arch enemy of the bankruptcy estate, that he intends to destroy this bankruptcy estate. And our view and what we communicated to the committee very clearly was we were going to be at odds with him. We were going to be adverse to him. We were going to be litigating with Mr. Hansen and with Mr. Ross Hansen. And we didn't want any of those communications or any of our dialogue coming out of the committee meeting, any disclosures we were going to make to the committee, to be passed to Mr. Ross Hansen. And what we found out was that there were such communications being fed to Mr. Ross Hansen. And that's what we were investigating. We were investigating whether there was somebody out there that was colluding with Ross Hansen, adverse to the interest of the bankruptcy estate. That's what I was trying to get to the bottom of.
Okay, but
we never told, I want to finish this part, Your Honor.
Sure.
We never told we never tried to obstruct any of the committee members from participating in a committee meeting. What we told Mr. Northrup and the other committee members was we weren't going to share information with anybody who was in Mr. Ross Hansen's camp and who was colluding with Mr. Ross Hansen. And what we discovered was that Mr. Bill Hansen was so colluding that he had several meetings with Ross Hansen, that he'd fed him a great deal of information, and that he had worked with Ross Hansen to craft a letter with the assistance of Ross Hansen's lawyers to try to have the trustee deposed. So why would we continue to produce information to committee members who were working adversely to the interest of the bankruptcy estate? That's what this investigation was about. And that's why Mr. Northrup agreed to allow me to go and to ask the committee members to clear the air. We wanted to continue to communicate to the committee. We wanted to continue, and we did. After we cleared the decks and people disclosed to us what their communications had and had not been with Mr. Hansen, we continued to have meetings and continued to provide information to all the remaining committee members.
I want to come back to my original question, though. You asserted that neither you nor the trustee had received any disclosure of communications that the Pels may have had with Ross Hansen. That statement was not true, correct?
I think the thrust of the statement, the intent of that statement, Your Honor, was that I had not received the declaration from the Pels.
It's not, what it says, though. Received any disclosure of communication. Here's where I'm going with this. You can't make false statements to someone to induce their conduct. As an officer of the court and as a lawyer under Washington Rules of Professional Conduct, you can't do that. You can't tell people something that isn't true. And that was not true, Mr. Guerin. That's what bothers me. This is very disturbing. When you tell someone directly, someone who's represented by a lawyer, by the way, who's sitting there listening to it, did you respond to Mr. Guerin's false statement, Mr. Northrup?
The statement you
just read? Yeah, that I just read.
I'm not aware of that.
Okay, so there's a false statement you know is false. Mr. Guerin, you know it's false. You're saying it to an unrepresented person to induce them to act. That is problematic. And you can spin it how you want. You cannot you can't tell someone you've produced nothing when you know they have. That is, Your Honor, I find this highly disturbing, Mr. Guerin.
I'm going to tell you, I'm getting frustrated with this.
I bet you are. You
falsely accused me of improperly contacting Mr. Bill Hansen, without permission from counsel. You made an ethical accusation against me, which was false. We're going back to this again. It is frustrating, and it is not true.
It is not true. I asked you if you had permission. I asked you, and you said.
But you assumed that I did not. You assumed that I did not have permission, and you made the accusation in court against me without having the facts to support it. And that, Your Honor, that is frustrating, and that is wrong. As an officer of this court, I take my responsibilities in this court very seriously. I take my ethical responsibilities extremely seriously. And the idea that you're going to suggest to me that I'm violating some ethical rule by contacting Ms. Pell in some fashion, it's just not true. The intent of that communication with Ms. Pell was to tell her, you have not disclosed to me like the other creditors committee members have, that you've followed up and produced to me this additional information, clearing the decks, and giving me the declaration that everyone else has given me. Did I state that inaccurately? I suppose I did. I mean, I don't even recall at this point, did I know? Had I seen the package of information that Mr. Northrup presented? I may have, I may not. But, Your Honor, I can tell you it was not that I was tending to deceive Ms. Pell and persuade her that she'd done nothing. She knew what she'd done. So the idea that there's been some ethical impropriety here or ethical violations on my part or by any of the other professionals in this case, I object to that strenuously, Your Honor. It's not true.
Mr. Guerin, this statement that you made to the Pells to require them to provide you documents and take some of their action was not true. It wasn't. It wasn't true. You had the documents from Mr. Northrup. So why would you say you've produced nothing? If you said you haven't produced a declaration, that's something else. That's not what you said. You've talked. Now I'm going to talk. Okay. You say that you had permission to contact Mr. Hansen. You contacted Mr. Hansen, all the committee members. Mr. Northrup didn't have a problem with that. I asked you. I was asking the questions. But I am concerned, and even if you have permission, this should have raised a red flag for you, talking to other people who have a lawyer, Mr. Northrup. Mr. Northrup should have been the one to do the investigation. But I'm going to put that aside for a second. This is disturbing on a lot of levels. And I don't like accusing anybody of not following the rules of professional conduct. But at the very least, this is all problematic. Let me say that in that same email, you stated that until they complied with your demands, the trustee will not share confidential information with them. What was your authority for not dealing with particular members of the committee?
I think that the trustee is free to share confidential information with any party in the case. And if we were to become adverse to the committee in the case.
Right. But
we could insist that the committee go through a formal discovery process to get information from us.
You can't pick and choose which committee members. That's what you're trying to do here. You're trying to say, we'll share it with the other committee members, but not you. What's your authority?
What we told Mr. Northrup was we wouldn't share information with the committee, period, unless the issues with the committee were cleared up. We put that onus on the committee to go and to manage its own affairs and to clean the committee up or to ensure that there was not going to be some collusion with members of the committee with Mr. Ross Hansen. That was the thrust of what we were involved in there.
Well, again,
I think that's within the trustee's purview. I think the trustee is fully entitled to determine if he's got an adverse party in the case that he will not share information.
I agree, and that's what your agreement says. The party is the committee. So either you share it with the committee or you don't share it with the committee. You as the trustee or debtor in possession, can't say, I want certain members of the committee to not get the information. I mean, unless you got some authority for that, I'm not aware of any. If you find that someone on the committee is violating their duties, shouldn't you go to Mr. Smith in the U.S. Trustee's office? Why do you get to decide who is and is not allowed to participate in committee activities?
We did not do that.
You said it in your email. That's what you were going to do. specifically, and again, I'm reading your email.
Your Honor, what we told Mr. Northrup was we would not be sharing information with the committee, period, if we didn't get to the bottom of those issues. And what the discussions we were having were, if there are members of the committee that are involved in this leak and this collusion with Mr. Hansen, we're not going to participate in any committee meetings until those issues are cleared up.
Here's your email. Until we reach the resolution of these issues satisfactory to the trustee will not share confidential information with you about the case, and we will expect that you will excuse yourselves from presentations made by the trustee to the committee. That's what you said to the Pels. What is your authority for even suggesting committee members can't participate in committee business?
Well, I've done a legal research on the issue, Your Honor, but what I can tell you is I think the trustee is free to say he will not produce or share information with the committee.
I agree with that.
If those committee members are going to participate. So that's what we were talking to Mr. Northrup about.
All right. Well, we're kind of beating a dead horse there. I've got your words, and you're now saying something different than what your words. So you can, you know my concerns with that May 10, 2017 email to the Pels. You can further discuss it in your declaration. In general, you made the demand on the committee members that they produce their documents regarding communications with Mr. Hansen. What was your authority to demand production of those documents?
Well, Your Honor, I think we have an ability to investigate all of the affairs of the bankruptcy estate. We could have gotten a 2004 order if we wanted.
Right, but that requires an order, which you didn't get.
It does, Mr. Bill Hansen, what I told him was that if he didn't produce the documents, that I would go get an order, that I would file a motion with the court to go obtain the information from him. So I was asking him to do it on an informal basis, and I was telling him that I would follow through with the court and get an order compelling the production of the documents if he didn't produce them to me. And I think that was well within the trustee's rights to do so, to investigate those matters. We were getting to the bottom of whether we could trust the committee in dealing with the furtherance of the reorganization of the bankruptcy estate.
All right. In your March 21, 2017 email to the committee, you stated in the email, the trustee has learned that some members of the committee have had ongoing communications with and have collaborated with Ross Hansen in adversity to the interests of the bankruptcy estate. The trustee has also learned that certain members of the committee have disclosed confidential information to Ross Hansen in violation of the written confidentiality agreement between the trustee and the members of the committee. So, what had you learned that led you to say that certain members, plural, of the committee had collaborated with Mr. Hansen in adversity to the interests of the bankruptcy estate?
I think I would have to research it, Your Honor, and go back and look at the dialogue that was going on at the time to get a full and fair statement regarding that. But so I think I'd prefer to go back and look at the emails.
Okay. But this comes back again. If you're overstating your case, that's a problem. You're telling people that you're accusing multiple members of the committee of violating their fiduciary duties because they're acting adversely to the interests of the estate. Give me all the evidence, as specific as you have, to support that allegation. And at that point, didn't you know that the person who had disclosed the confidential information was Bill Hansen, right? Was there anyone else you suspected of disclosing confidential information at that point?
As of that date, I'm not sure, Your Honor. I know that we learned that Mr. Bill Hansen, he admitted that he had shared information with the Bressler information with Ross Hansen, but I can't remember the specific date, honestly, that he disclosed that to me. I thought it was after the 17th, but I could be wrong about that.
I believe it was before the 17th. I mean, because if you knew by then, unless you had some evidence that somebody else was disclosing information, why was it reasonable and necessary to go through all this effort? If you had the culprit identified, why were you going through all that?
We didn't know.
Well, we didn't know, Your Honor, and I think that...
But What suspicions did you have that somebody else, I mean, put this in your declaration. Did you have suspicions that somebody else was disclosing information? Because if you didn't, I got a question why you did all that. What was the benefit to the estate? You had the guilty party. He fessed up, said he was going to resign. So unless you had some reason to think somebody else was acting adversely to the interest of the estate, I don't understand why you went through all this and continued all the way through May 10 threatening the Pells unless they provide you everything you were demanding, that you were going to expect them to not participate in the committee meeting. This was obviously a big deal, which is why I'm focusing on it, because you thought it was a huge deal. And so I'm going to focus on it too. And so you've made a number of statements that you're now going to need to back up. Lawyers are communicating with unrepresented parties, have a higher duty of making sure that what they're saying is accurate. Okay, so you'll need to put that in your your declaration. Finally, I need copies of all your communications with Richard Bressler and or his counsel since March 1, 2017 to present. All right, that takes care of Mr. Guerin. Mr. New, I've got one series of questions for you regarding the litigation with Diane Erdman.
Yes.
All right. Your response seemed to be aimed primarily at disagreeing with how the condition of Ms. Erdman at the time of litigation, or the characterization of Ms. Erdman. I called her judgment proof. Mr. Calvert, in a declaration in support of the motion for a prejudgment writ, said that if the prejudgment writ is granted, there were no known assets available to satisfy a judgment. You can call it what you want. I call that judgment proof because I denied the motion. But it doesn't really matter what you call it. The question is, have you collected any amounts on the judgment against Ms. Erdman?
Not at this point, Your Honor. And I'll tell you, we are intending to bring very shortly a motion to execute on the sheriff's seized inventory. We are pursuing through negotiation recovery of some of the monies that she may have paid on behalf of Medallic. So that's in process as well. So we will be bringing before the court a motion to execute on the sheriff's seized inventory. I'll be clear, Your Honor, there's an issue where I think Bradley Cohen believes that inventory belonged to Ross Hansen, so we'll need to resolve that issue. And in fact, over the last 2 weeks, I've been in communication with his counsel over how to resolve that issue and get that asset executed upon.
Okay. All right. I look forward to that motion. Do you have any estimate on the amount of recovery on the Erdman judgment?
Well, the sheriff's seized inventory is about $180,000. And we are in discussions where the estate would net approximately $130,000 out of that sheriff's seized inventory. The amounts that Diane Erdman paid on behalf of Medallic Art Company.
Remember, were like hundreds of thousands.
It was over $300,000, between $300,000 and $400,000.
Yeah, I think more than the judgment, maybe.
More than that.
Yes. All right. So you are negotiating with some of the recipients of those monies. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. So you do expect to receive some return on that
hopefully we would get recovery without having to pursue further litigation.
Right? All right. Thank you for that. All right. Mr. Northrup. Again, this is kind of back to the disclosure of confidential information. Mr. Hansen, Ms. Pell, obviously it was a big deal to a number of folks, and it's a big deal to the court. This letter from Mr. Hansen, William Hansen, that you received from him, you forwarded to Mr. Guerin about 30 minutes later. Why did you forward Mr. Hansen's letter to Mr. Guerin, and how did you doing so benefit the estate or the committee?
I did it for informational purposes, Your Honor. That was the letter that Mr. Hansen demanded that I immediately file with the court and turn into a public document. Right. It was strictly informational.
What? But you didn't file it with the court?
No, I did not.
So I was never aware of what Mr. Hansen's issue was, but Mr. Calvert and Mr. Guerin were, correct?
They had seen the letter.
Right. So, but why provide your client's letter to someone your client's clearly adverse to?
Again, I didn't see it as a disclosure of any confidential information from a client. Again, his intention was that that letter be made a public document. And even his email, even the first email that he transmitted to me before he transmitted the letter said, and I don't care if you file this email with the court.
But you didn't file him with the court. Why didn't you file him with the court then? You've explained it. I understand why you believe it was a bad idea to file it with the court. But if you don't file it with the court, why share it with the enemy of Mr. Hansen? That was Mr. Calvert was his enemy at that point. It's fair to say.
Which Hansen, Bill or Ross?
Bill Hansen. Well, both.
Yeah.
Bill.
Yeah. That's the question.
Yeah,
that's the real question
there. Thank you for that clarification. William Hansen, the member of the committee, was very unhappy with Mark Calvert.
Yes.
That letter makes it clear, wants him gone.
Correct.
You share that with Mr. Calvert, I assume to help Mr. Calvert in some way. Why would you do that?
Again, I regarded that as an administrative informational disclosure. I mean, the concern that I had obviously was that there were one or two people on the committee who were very aggressively trying to have Mr. Calvert removed, which would have been a terrible, foolhardy thing to do at the time when we're weeks away from the Medallic trial, the business is operating, the consequences to the estate of the committee taking a position that it wanted to remove the trustee would have destroyed the estate. Mr. Calvert as trustee, I mean, hypothetically, even if the committee instructed me to file a motion to remove the trustee, number one, I had consistently advised them that there was no statutory basis for this. I don't think there was any evidence that he was operating the estate outside of the purview of his business judgment. But again, hypothetically, if he had been removed, who would have replaced him? Nobody would have taken this engagement. What would have happened to his law firm? What would have happened to his accounting firm that had been sustaining this case for months, pouring millions of dollars worth of professional services into this? The case would have collapsed. It would have turned into a liquidation.
I understand that you believed it was a bad idea. So why not just keep the letter to yourself?
I suppose I could. I suppose I could have contacted Mr. Guerin and said, you know, it's come to my attention that some people on the committee want to have Mr. Calvert removed as trustee.
That's a privilege. That's privileged. I mean, you would never do that. You would not call somebody and say, my client wants your client out. You would not do that. That's a clear violation of the attorney-client privilege. So you would not have done that.
Not if your client says, turn this into a public document for the world to see.
But you don't turn it into a public document. Did you tell William Hansen that you weren't going to do that?
The timing of all this happened almost simultaneously because the date I received that letter was literally 12, 18 hours before the issue of the Hansen disclosure of the Bressler settlement occurred. These events were almost simultaneous. And the minute the Bressler issue came to the surface, Mr. Hansen announced that he was resigning from the committee. I shared that information with the trustee, too, because that's an administrative fact of life in the case. There's nothing confidential about that. But all these things happened virtually simultaneously, Your Honor.
I know a lot was going on, but him resigning is something that's just an administrative act. A member of your committee wanting you to pursue a motion to remove Mr. Calvert is not an administrative act. It's a pretty, obviously very serious. There is authority, Section 324 of the code allows for the removal of a trustee. not routinely granted by any stretch of the imagination. And so if you told the committee it will never happen, that's not accurate. If you told the committee it's extremely unlikely, that's a fair assessment. Putting that aside for the moment, I'm hung up on the notion that you would share that information, that letter, with Mr. Calvert and Mr. Guerin to give them a heads up that someone on your committee, one or more people, wants them out. That only helps them, right? It helps Mr. Guerin and Mr. Calvert prepare for something in some way, right?
Well, it's information, Your Honor. And again, this was my professional legal business judgment that if somebody gives you a document and says, I want you to turn this into a public document for the world to see, I don't view that document as being a confidence that I couldn't share with anybody.
Okay.
And that's my position. If I'm wrong on that, I'll take the court's medicine for that.
Well, it's not only that you shared it with somebody, but you then didn't do what the client asked you to do, which is turn it into a public document.
Right. Well,
that's the problem I have is that you can't have it both ways. You can't say, yeah, it was a public document, so I shared it with Mr. Calvert, but I didn't do what my client asked, and I didn't tell my client I wasn't going to do what he asked. Did you tell the client you were going to share it with Mr. Or maybe you did.
Again, that letter came from Mr. Hansen individually. It did not come from the committee. It was not voted on by the committee. I was not instructed by a vote of the committee to do anything.
I understand. I understand that, but you should, well, in the view of the court, you should not have shared it with Mr. Guerin and Mr. Calvert then. If you weren't going to take any action on it, there'd be no point in sharing it with them other than to try to help Mr. Guerin and Mr. Calvert. And if you haven't noticed, the only people on the committee, either current or former members, are not supporting, I don't see any support of your fee application. The narrative several people are drawing is that you were trying to run interference for Mr. Calvert. This act doesn't help you refute that accusation. In fact, it supports the notion that you're trying to give Mr. Calvert a heads up. Did you ask Mr. Hansen, can I disclose this to Mr. Calvert, Mr. William Hansen?
I didn't feel that I needed to. He had instructed me to turn it into a public document. He demanded that I turn it into a public document. I'm sorry. In my practice, I don't view that as a confidence between client and attorney that needs to be protected, that's subject to protection.
Okay, so then let's then turn to the Bressler Settlement Agreement. Mm-hmm. It says on its face that it's to be immediately filed with the court, right?
I don't even remember seeing that, Your
Honor. It was going to be turned into a public document, right? I mean, it was going to be filed as part of a motion to approve the settlement, right? The Bressler Settlement Agreement?
Yes, it was. When I was advised by the trustee that there had been an agreement with Mr. Bressler, I never saw the agreement. I advised the committee that there was an agreement with Mr. Bressler, but I hadn't even seen the document at that point.
But it was intended to be public, whatever agreement there was.
Well, of course it was, and it was brought before the court, and the court denied it.
So that's why I'm trying to understand why there was this. Everyone got apoplectic when Mr. William Hansen disclosed the existence of an agreement that was going to be public. Why was everyone apoplectic about that?
Well, again, I think,
Your Honor, if I may answer,
I think it was a breach of the non-disclosure provisions of the joint defense agreement that Mr. Hansen had personally signed.
I understand, but then wouldn't that apply just the same way to your agreement or your duty to not disclose confidential information from your client without the client's permission? You didn't get William Hansen's permission to disclose the letter that he wanted to be publicly filed. But
I didn't think I needed that, Your Honor.
Do I think so?
I didn't think I needed that.
I gather that now, but obviously I, again, it's kind of coming back to, if Mr. William Hansen's disclosure of a settlement that was intended to be public is a violation of or disclosure of confidential information, it seems like that should be applies exactly the same to William Hansen's letter to you that if even though it was supposed to be made public, if you disclosed it, if it was made to you in confidence, you can't disclose it without permission. I mean, that's my view of it. If you want to address this further in a declaration, you may do so, but that's the problem I see here. The committee is opposing the fee applications of the trustee, Cascade Capital, and K&L Gates, correct?
I filed a response to that fee application, the fee applications when they were originally filed. That's correct.
And so that's the committee's view, correct?
That's.
Well, I want to correct the record on that, Your Honor. I don't think that's accurate. I think
okay.
that Mr. Northrup, as committee counsel, filed a response, but I do not see that the committee itself has filed any response to the fee applications.
Mr. Northrup would probably know best.
That is correct. The committee never voted or instructed me to respond one way or another to the professional fee applications for the obvious practical reason that there wasn't enough money even to pay those.
I got it. I stand corrected. Thank you. I'd like to get copies of all the committee meeting minutes and of the committee bylaws, if you could attach that to your declaration. Let's see. Can you provide me the copy of the email that you sent to Mr. Guerin attaching the communications you received from the Pels regarding their communications with Ross Hansen? You could send that, attach that email and the attachments.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to see copies of all communications that you sent to Mr. Guerin or anyone else at K&L Gates that mention or refer to Richard Pell, Paula Pell, and or William Hansen from February 1st, 2017 to present. I think that's what I have. All right. This has not been a hearing that anyone was looking forward to, myself included, and I clearly have some issues. I fully gather that the professionals don't agree with where I'm coming from, but you've heard where I'm coming from. I'm going to give you an opportunity to file further declarations that respond to what I'm saying in court today. And if you'd like to say anything further today, I'll open up the floor. Actually, let me ask, Mr. Smith, is a U.S. trustee, have anything to say about any of this? All right, so the U.S. trustee has nothing to offer at this time. All right. Is there anyone that would like to say anything further? Mr. Northrup?
We will respond, Your Honor. Thank
All right,
you.
The writing. Thank you. Mr. Guerin?
Your Honor, briefly, I have one thought that I was going to broach with the court this morning, and I want to find out, get a reaction from the court as to whether this might make a difference in the way that we are approaching things. And from my view, where we are at this point is there's a limited amount of money left in the estate. All of the allowed administrative claims, except for the $10,000 claim, $9,300 of two creditors have been paid. I think the trustee, and we can ask Mr. Northrup, but he'd consent to this. I think we consent to paying those if that made a difference to the way the court was viewing things. We could clear the decks on the other administrative debt. And what I'd been thinking about was whether the court would consider doing an interim award and reserving issues about the allowance of more than, say, $2 million worth of fees and expenses. And whether we could, if we got to the end of the case and there really is insufficient assets to pay any of these claims, we could waive them. And then there wouldn't be these controversies that the court may have to wade into in terms of whether there should be allowance of $6 million worth of claims. I will note that there's about another $1 million worth of fees that have been incurred subsequent to the September 30 period that I think we have our cutoff on that we haven't applied for, and we know that we're not going to get paid for. Additional services that have been provided to the state. Right, that includes the trustees and the Cascades and the Cano gaze fees. So, Your Honor, I'm just asking for a reaction as to whether that might make a difference as to how we might approach it, and whether we could avoid unnecessary controversy and headache if we were to go at it in that manner.
I appreciate that, Mr. Guerin, and I always like to avoid controversy and headaches when I can. Part of the problem, though, is I honestly am not sure what I'm going to do with these fee applications. I have some serious concerns that are not just about whether fees were reasonable and necessary, but I have some concerns about whether representations to the court were accurate, and if not, whether that would warrant further discount. And I haven't gone through all the numbers yet to know if there's any possibility that the disallowance of professional fees, and to be clear, there will be some disallowed, may take the allowed professional fees below $2 million. I don't know. I'm cognizant of the professionals continuing to work for free. On the other hand, this could have been avoided with periodic fee applications. Professionals chose not to do that. And so now we're here kind of at the end. Perhaps periodic fee applications may have brought some of these issues to a head a long time ago, such we wouldn't be in this place. The professionals made the decision, and kind of here we are. And I appreciate that offer, but at this point, I don't know what I'm going to do with the fee applications. And I have a duty, whether or not there are any objections, to evaluate fee applications, and we clearly have plenty of objections. As I said, I've got serious concerns about Mr. Calvert's disclosures. Let me give you another example that I didn't raise. In December of 2016, on the 30th of that month, there was an $8,907.56 payment to, quote, transfer, close quote, and the description for the payment was, quote, transfer. Apparently now that is a reimbursement to the trustee, because that's the number that matches what's on Mr. Calvert's trustee expenses. $8,907.56 on 12/30/2016, according to his list of trustee expenses. You know, why would you label it transfer? I know these are small numbers, but I'm going to go back to what Mr. New argued in the adversary proceeding against Ms. Erdman. That was her defense. These are all small numbers, and yeah, $10,000 a month was payable for corporate expenses, and only $1,000 were mine. So, you know, why are you suing me? And Mr. New argued successfully that it all adds up. Same argument applies here. It all adds up. And as an officer of the court, you have a duty to be accurate. And as you said, you've done thousands of monthly operating reports. You should know better. So I don't know what I'm going to do with your fee application, Mr. Calvert. I don't know what I'm going to do with the expenses of Canal Gates that are not separated by category. I don't know what I'm going to do. So I'm afraid that this has to, this matter requires further answers to these issues. And the only way I could see around it is if the professionals were to take some voluntary discounts, and maybe that would, you know, I don't know. I don't know. I'm trying to think of a way that avoids further work because for a lot of reasons, I don't want to continue doing this. This is not fun for anybody. And I don't like, Mr. Guerin, I don't like this conversation we've had because you and Mr. Northrup and Mr. New are excellent lawyers, have a great reputation. I don't know what happened here. Something happened, and I don't know what it is. I'm not sure I'll ever know what it is, but something happened here that is not appropriate. And it's deeply concerning, and I don't know what I'm going to do with it. So I want to give you a chance to respond because I don't want to have that hanging out there, these accusations. I want to give you a chance to fully respond to them because they've been raised by other parties. I didn't sua sponte raise these issues. Other parties did. Other members of the committee did. So I need to take them seriously. And frankly, I'm not pleased with the written responses I got most recently, which basically just say these are inadmissible ramblings of folks. They are not. So I'm going to take them seriously. I'm going to investigate them. But you get a chance to respond. And then the record will have your thoughtful, careful response to these very serious accusations. And I hope they resolve them. So then appreciate the offer, but I think I need to continue in the manner that I suggested. So I'm gonna give the parties an opportunity to file further responses to these issues. The question is how long and how far do we continue this out? Sure. I mean, if you're asking for like an interim compensation, just of some limited amount, is that what you're asking for, just to get something? Because I know the shoes you guys are in. I get it. I have sympathy on some hand. On the other hand, again, as I said, you guys kind of waited until now. We could have done interim fee applications. But, excuse me. Are you proposing some sort of interim award with a continuation?
I think what's best, Your Honors, we should probably submit that in writing to the court because I'm hearing you that you want us to shore the record up. And I think we welcome the opportunity to do that.
That's what I think is best for everybody.
So I think I'm fine with that, but then I think as part of that submission, my expectation is we'll consult with Mr. Northrup about what we could do, and we will work with presenting a proposal for an interim award of some kind and deferring or waiving some aspect of the fees.
I like that. If you can put that in your responsive papers, what I'll do is I'll continue this hearing and I can decide at that continued hearing whether to make an interim award of some amount. And then I likely am going to take this matter under advisement.
All right, Your Honor.
All right. So how much time do we want for filing these additional papers? It's February 1. I mean, it's 2 weeks enough time? 3 weeks? 4 weeks?
I think it's going to take a few weeks, Your Honor, and I've got some other things going on as well.
All right.
So maybe we could put it on the March 1 calendar, and could we file on the 22nd?
Sure. Is that going to work for you, Mr.? Okay.
I'm in state court on March 1.
All right. We have a 105 conference on that day I prefer to set this at 11. 15th is fine. Okay. March 15 is open at 11. How about March 15 at 11? And you have until March 1 to file everything? Oh, wait a minute.
My hesitation, Your Honor, is I believe that is our St. Patrick's Day celebration.
Ah, gotcha. I don't want to.
Which is that Friday, which is fairly important in my neck of the
woods. I will not interfere with that. Let's see. I don't want to keep pushing this out. Neither do you. So. What do we have at 1:30 on the 1st?
That's the setting, the 4th, 5th, or 6th.
Oh. We're looking at perhaps 1:30 on March 1. Would that be possible?
I can't be. I'm in court in every.
Oh, that's right. You said you're in state court on the first. I'm sorry. Quickly, I forgot. So we could specially set it, which I will do. I can't do the 7th. It's on the 5th. Trials Act. About the 8th. That week, I know. Odds of them both going, though, are low. All right. Well, so we're looking at either March 8, March, what do we say, 12, 13? No, sorry. March 8, March 13, or March 14. Anyone have preferences for those dates?
Mr. Calvert says he prefers the 13th, and I'm going to check really quickly if that's available.
Mr. Northrup, how does that sound for you?
That's okay with me.
All right.
March 13th works for me as well, Your Honor.
All right. So we can do it. We can start at any time, 9:30, 11, 1:30. Should we just say 9:30 or 10?
So you said 9:30 at?
We could start 9:30, 10 o'clock, either one. I mean, with traffic nowadays, I've been starting things at 10. If people have to come from any place outside the downtown core, sometimes it's a pain, though. Should we just say 9:30 on March 13, unless someone wants 10 o'clock?
I don't think it makes a difference to me one or the other, Your Honor.
Let's just say 9:30. Mr. Smith, I haven't asked you, but is that going to work for you?
That's fine, yeah.
All right. So March 13, we'll continue this hearing to March 13 at 9:30. Let's get your any additional materials by March 1, all right? And you don't have to do any further notice to anyone.
Could we indulge and submit materials on the 4th of March? Mr. Calvin's apparently got.
Sure. So any additional materials will be due on March, by the end of the day on March 4, 2019. I'll have that reflected by a minute entry. You don't need anything further. All right. Anything further from anyone else? All right. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Court will be in recess.
All right.